age. So please join with me in welcoming Professor Scruton.
Thank you very much, Rob, for those kind words, and thank you for inviting me. I propose to talk just for half an hour around this very difficult and broad topic, it's a topic about which it's difficult to speak for reasons which I will try and identify, but a topic which for that reason I think we're all under an obligation to speak about. And really what I want to discuss is just what has happened to our society that in adopting a secular vision of things, it has also become ever more orthodox about what that vision should be. Now, by secular, I mean that the principal institutions which govern our conduct, which govern the order of social events, which govern the law and politics, that these are primarily, in fact, increasingly, almost all of them, of a secular disposition. They're not backed up by any particular religious creed or any particular religious offices or any particular religious orthodoxies. The idea has been prevalent since the Enlightenment, indeed, that our forms of government ought to make no distinction between the creeds, religious creeds that they accept and those that they don't accept. They must be defined independently of any religious worldview, and increasingly that means independently of any particular moral worldview too. Now this idea of secular government has its antecedents long before the Enlightenment. Indeed, many people would say that it's actually already there in the Gospels. In the famous parable of the tribute money, as you will remember, as related in the Gospel of St. Matthew, Christ says, "Render unto Caesar what is Caesar's, and to God what is God's," meaning that there is a secular order which we all share, which is the order of civil government, and that demands of us certain commitments and certain gifts and certain sacrifices. And then there is another order which we bear, as it were, within ourselves, which is the order of religious obedience and religious commitment. And the existence of that parable has often been pointed to as one of the major distinctions historically between Christianity and Islam. There's nothing in the foundational text of Islam which makes any such distinction between the religious obedience and the civil obedience of the individual. Both obediences come from the same source, which is the law laid down by God through the voice of his prophet, and there is no way in the end that the two orders can be distinguished. And this has become a serious issue for us living in states like our own, which are downstream from the Christian revelation, where we are now admitting large minorities of Muslims for whom the idea of a secular order is not one that they readily understand. That for them, for many of them at least, law becomes legitimate only if it can be derived from the will of God, and that means that ultimately the law must be Sharia, otherwise it doesn't have any real authority other than that of the people who happen to be imposing it. And I think we should be grateful that we, when we think about this, that we do exist in a secular order, that we do exist in a civil society which is governed by laws which are made by people for people, and which evolve over time according to the needs of those people, which are changed in obedience to the changing circumstances and so on. None of this is true of the Sharia, which ever since the 11th century has been static. It's been a law which is supposed to be of eternal validity, indeed to have preceded any law that any human being has ever invented, since it has been implanted in us all from eternity by God. And to think of the law in that way, of course, is to already to take a very suspicious attitude towards those who would happen to belong to some other faith, or who belong to no faith at all. So we should be grateful that we have a secular order which enables us to live under a rule-governed system of jurisdiction with people whom we disagree with profoundly about many of the issues of the day. But there are real questions as to how that is possible. My own view is that you can only live under a proper secular jurisdiction of this kind if you also share your obedience to something else. It can't be just the law that holds things in place. And in our part of the world, I say in Europe generally, this other form of obedience has taken a national form. We identify ourselves as members of a particular nation, defined in terms of territory. The law operates over that territory, and our obedience comes because we belong in that territory. That territory is ours. But this, of course, is again something that has been put in question by mass migrations and so on, and not to speak of all the problems of the two world wars. So, although we should be grateful that we live in a secular order, it is not without enormous internal tensions, which we are, I think, living through now. But one consequence of a secular order of the kind I've described is that religion becomes privatized. Those of you who study political philosophy will be well aware of the views of John Rawls and his famous theory of justice, in which he assigns religion, morality, and all kinds of other things to what he calls conceptions of the good, regarding them as in some way private possessions of people to be negotiated in the settlement of the ultimate political order, and not having any specific authority in determining how the political order should be. And that is only one way of capturing something which I think is accepted widely in our societies, which is that religion is a private matter. It's something between you and God, and insofar as possible, something that you should keep to yourself and not allow to run out, to flow out into the commerce of daily life. And we all, again, feel a certain sympathy for that, we also recognize that one of the principal demands of religion, including the Christian religion, is to witness to that religion in your day-to-day affairs. So there's another tension which grows within secular government between the demand of religion that it should be declared and witnessed to, and the demand of the secular order that religion should be regarded as private. So the result of these tensions, I think, is something that we're seeing now in the society in which we live. We're seeing emerging a desire for and a move towards a kind of shared secular morality which will back up the secular order, the secular political order, from a standpoint of social and moral orthodoxy. That's just what I want to move on to talking about, the emerging orthodoxies. I think we should never underestimate the human need for orthodoxy. All disagreements are potentially painful, but disagreements about the matters on which you base your daily life, on which the things to which you turn for consolation and authority, disagreement about that is always difficult for people. And the natural human desire is to associate only with those who share your orthodoxies. It's very difficult to live in the situation that we have created, where the views prevailing in the public world may be in radical tension with our private beliefs. And it, for this reason, there has always been a great difficulty in establishing toleration as a form of ordinary political life. In the 17th century, our societies went through a period, as you know, of enormous conflict following the Reformation and the wars of religion and so on. And toleration became the issue of the day. Can we build a society in which toleration is the norm? And John Locke wrote a famous treatise on this, in which he said, yes, you can. It is possible to have a society in which toleration is the norm, provided you didn't allow Catholics. Given the fact that there were Catholics were the only people who dissented from the views that prevailed in the society of his day, this wasn't really very helpful. Nevertheless, it was something. The reason why he said this is interesting, he said, this is because Catholics owe a loyalty to a source of authority outside the kingdom. Toleration is possible when people acknowledge a shared obedience to the king, to the authorities within the kingdom, a shared obedience to the king and his law, roughly. And then within that, we can allow the privatization of many, many different faiths. But given the fact that the secular authorities are not regarded as legitimate by the Catholics, we cannot tolerate them. Now, you can see his point, because after all, we're now living through exactly the same situation, that there are among us people who do not accept the legitimacy of the secular authorities and who regard legitimacy as stemming from a source outside the kingdom, indeed outside the world. So this brings home to us how very difficult toleration really is. Many people think that since the Enlightenment, toleration has just become second nature to us. You know, it just doesn't matter to us that somebody disagrees with us about moral, political, religious issues. This is simply something we've learned how to live with. But actually, I don't think we have, because toleration does not mean indifference. It doesn't mean simply not caring anymore about issues of morality, religion, or political orientation or whatever. On the contrary, toleration means accepting to live with people whom you really, really profoundly disagree with. And that is the difficulty. Can you really, really live with people in those circumstances where you actually think that their worldview is horrible, corrupt, poisonous, maybe even evil, and yet there you are, neighbours under a shared jurisdiction? And that is the problem that our society has now moved round to confronting. And what we find, I think, is that indeed there's a kind of pretend tolerance towards every possible view, which is based on the assumption that nobody seriously holds any view anyway. And you can live with people easily on that assumption, on the assumption that there are no such things as moral views, religious views, and so on. And a kind of thing that looks like tolerance emerges, but it isn't tolerance at all, because it depends upon an orthodoxy. It depends upon excluding all those who actually believe something. And I think this is one of the things that Christians are beginning to find in the society that we have today. And this new orthodoxy, I think, focuses on certain secular ideas which have come in the minds of many people to replace the religious ideas which formed the foundation of the moral views of people in this country and in the West generally until very recently. Ideas like that of human rights, which are supposedly bequeathed to us by our reasoning powers, that's what Kant said at least, These are rights which we just discern in the nature of things, which we recognize everybody to have, and which the upholding of which is sufficient to guarantee some kind of shared consensual political and social order. There is some truth in this, that there is there is something that we can all share in the idea of a human right, which does seem to generalize across the various religious traditions. But we soon find that when it put into practice, there isn't any real agreement about what human rights are. If you take issues, difficult issues like abortion, euthanasia, and so on, it becomes very clear that that people will declare a human right, the human right of a woman to have an abortion as part of her natural right to possess her own body, and find themselves opposed to those who say that fetuses as human beings have the human right to life. So who wins the argument? That's just one example of issues which you've come across in every area of human conflict in our times, where people invoke the idea of human rights on both sides of a difficult question, and nobody is able to determine who is right. So in other words, precisely by being made into a new orthodoxy, it begins to lose its specific content, its specific sense. And for this reason, I think, people have built in to the idea of human rights another and yet more open notion, the notion of non-discrimination. And I want to finish by just saying a few things about that, because it impacts, in my view, very strongly on the Christian worldview, not to speak of other worldviews too. If you look at the pronouncements of the European Court of Human Rights and also the legislation of the European Union, which now fills 180,000 pages, of which nobody knows more than three, you will find that the idea of non-discrimination is built in to judicial process from the beginning. All laws passed by the European Union have to comply with the requirement of non-discrimination, and it's applied by the European Court of Human Rights so as constantly to annihilate the distinctions that people make and perhaps have to make in order to conduct their daily lives. Non-discrimination meaning that no legislative act, no political decision should discriminate between people on grounds judged to be irrelevant. But what are these grounds? A list is given, things like race, nationality, religion, sex. Then, of course, sexual orientation is added. And it always ends with an etc., as though we spontaneously know exactly what is being excluded. But, of course, as soon as you think about it, you realize that all of life is based on discrimination. Marriage is an outrageous discrimination between one woman and her rivals, or one man and his rivals. Yet we don't want to rule out that, or do we? Employment involves discrimination between the qualified person and the unqualified. But for a recent immigrant, it's more important than that. It means discrimination between the person he can trust, which tends to be from his own immigrant community, and the person he can't, because he doesn't understand the language and so on. Now, that latter form of discrimination is a crime in our law, but and people do get prosecuted for it. But nevertheless, it's one that comes naturally to someone who wants to set up a business in a strange and forbidding place. If you look at all the forms of human life that you are engaged in, you will see some form of discrimination is going to be present in every serious decision you make. So how do you apply this basic human right. And it has increasingly become the test, this human right, as to the legitimacy or otherwise of an arrangement. And it's beginning to impact upon the Christian communities of Europe. As you know, there was a judgment of the European Court of Human Rights which declared that the Italian practice of hanging crucifixes in schoolrooms was an offence against the non-discrimination requirement, because it was a way of emphasising one religion against all the other possibilities. Not that any of those other possibilities have been entertained in Italy until recently, but this judgment was made, has since been reversed, but there's a campaign to bring it back again, a campaign especially from the atheist humanists and so on. Judgments of our own courts of law have come up with interesting conclusions in employment law, that, for instance, an air hostess cannot display a crucifix around her neck, because that, again, offends against non-discrimination axiom by privileging one religion over all the alternatives. A nurse has been sacked by the National Health Service for praying by the bedside of her patient. And again, that was upheld by the employment tribunal on non-discrimination grounds. And so on. I think you'll find quite a lot of these, but perhaps obviously the most important ones have been to do with sexuality. Recently, again, a case that you will all be familiar with, a Christian family that offers itself as foster parents for a local council in England was held to be incompetent to take charge of children because of their Christian disposition to bring children up in the traditional Christian view about homosexuality. That was regarded as discriminatory against homosexuals, in other words, to offend against the rule that there should be no discrimination on grounds of sexual orientation. And the judge actually said that in modern circumstances, that provision takes precedence over any provision that people shouldn't be discriminated against on grounds of religion. You know, you can see you could manufacture any result you want from the use of this kind of provision, but in general, the results tend to in a certain direction. They tend towards the delegitimization of traditional Christian ways of being and the public display of Christian faith and Christian practices, and of course the maintenance in the public sphere of Christian morality in the matter of sex. Recently, Parliament was discussing the problems of teenage pregnancy and all the rest, and one female MP said that sex education ought to be changed so the principal requirement was that girls were told to say no. They should be taught that. And this was greeted with, of course, hoots of mockery and radical assaults on this the MP in question from people like Polly Toynbee and other enlightened journalists, saying that, you know, this is intolerable attempt to impose a particular moral vision and one that belongs to a vanished age. This orthodoxy, and I'm sure you agree with me that this orthodoxy is growing around us, is sustained by the invention of certain phobias. If you disagree with it, it's not that you disagree, you are suffering from some deep psychological fault. As this began with the European Union's attack on any kind of nationalism, any kind of attempt to defend the nation state as the background of legal order, which is routinely dismissed as racism and xenophobia, which is a crime across much of Europe. To that was added homophobia, of course, and which means that anybody who disagrees with the current secular morality about homosexuality, namely who doesn't think that homosexuality is just the same as heterosexuality, only with someone of your own sex, such a person is not just disagreeing with you, he's suffering from a psychological disorder, a kind of phobia. And then, of course, we have Islamophobia as well, which is a crime in Belgium. Now, of course, people do suffer from phobias, and unfortunately, the phobias that are admitted as genuine problems are only those that are suffered by people who disagree with the liberal orthodoxy, the secular orthodoxy. You know, so, there isn't such a thing as Christophobia or conservatophobia or other things with which one can accuse the critics of the position that I'm taking. Because the mark of an orthodoxy is that it doesn't need that kind of defence, and that there isn't anything other than sanity that speaks in its favour. Now, of course, all these issues I've just mentioned, especially sexual morality, are controversial, and it's not entirely clear what Christians should believe about all of them. But I think the fact is that we are seeing emerging some kind of, not just non-Christian, but anti-Christian orthodoxy, especially in places like Belgium, where the church has begun to suffer from the attack of vested interests. In Belgium today, there are organized movements for unbaptism. Until recently, a newly born child was registered with the church and baptized, and now there are circles of young people who get together to write to the church, declaring themselves unbaptized and demanding certificates of unbaptism. The church, needless to say, has said nothing in response to this, but just hidden its face a little bit further in its surplice. The question then is, what should a Christian do about this, if anything? As yet, there is no sign that Christianity is persecuted, although possibly you would have to be quiet about being a Christian if you were applying for certain jobs. I guess if you're applying for a job in the University of Oxford, you might have to be a little bit discreet. You might have to say that, you know, you had Christian leanings, but you regarded it as a weakness to be overcome. traditionally, Christians have had an answer to this, which is that they should bear witness to their faith in public. They've had this extraordinary example, the founder of their religion, who didn't just bear witness to what he said, but patiently accepted the worst that people could do by way of mocking, scorning, and punishing him. Would it ever come to that? One of the interesting things I think that we observe in the world today is that the Christians who do bear witness are often laughed at in the traditional way that they'd be expected to be laughed at, or chased out of their job, like the nurse who prayed for her patient and so on. But that other forms of witness are taken very seriously. The Islamic shahada, the witnessing of the faith, can take place by killing an awful lot of innocent people. And that is regarded as a form of martyrdom. The person who does it is the shaheed, the person who has witnessed to the faith. Nobody finds that peculiar. And indeed, it has led to an enhanced respect for Islam in our societies. The fact that Islam is so dangerous has led to a kind of space being made for it in every law that is contemplated and in the public discourse. And this space is guaranteed by the threat of Islamophobia against anybody who says that this is wrong. So that form of witness seems to be accepted as a perfectly legitimate part of the contest of the powers in the world in which we live.